You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
They say that time heals all wounds, but our guest today argues that time only passes. It's what we do with that time that truly mends a broken soul. Patrick Neo Mabiletsa is a man who has turned his deepest voids into a roadmap for others. As one of South Africa's most resonant voices on mental health, grief, and the silent epidemic of fatherlessness, his journey is a masterclass in emotional resilience. He is the author of several books, including Chronicles of a Fatherless Son and the deeply personal Does Time Really Heal? But beyond the titles and the Mabiletsa Group CEO desk, he is a man who once stood at the edge of his own darkness and chose to walk back and turn on the light for the rest of us. Please help me welcome Patrick Neo Mabiletsa. Hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm great. That's a beautiful profile. Please send it to me. I didn't know.
You'll definitely get it. You'll definitely get it. And you're hearing this profile, but I'm pretty sure there's so much more I did not cover in that intro. So please tell us a little bit about yourself and some of the challenges that you faced growing up that contributed to who you are today.
Oh, the challenges I faced growing up. I think the most daunting one was growing up without a father.
Yeah.
Not knowing, you know, any man that I could walk past could be my dad. So I grew up with this thing of looking and listening, because obviously my uncles are taller. Everybody at home, they're tall. I'm not short, but I'm just average height. And I've always wondered, where am I from? What are my roots? Mm. Who are my sisters, brothers, cousins, my aunts from my father's side, you know? I forgot about it a while until I was in high school, where they asked us to do an essay about a father.
Oh, no.
And it really started to bother me. Many years later, I decided, man, let me just do some research and find out if there are men like me, only to realize that like 60% of black homes are fatherless. You know, so that was a challenge for me for a very long time. But in brief, Neo is an author. He's somebody who believes in resilience, that nothing that God allows can destroy you unless you just give up. So I've grown up with the motto of saying, never ever give up. No matter what happens, no matter which challenge you face. And I think that's what defines me, to say, if you look at what the things that have happened to me, you know, I try not to say that the things that I've gone through, but things that have happened, because those things did not define me, but instead they grew me and made me a better person.
So good. So good. You know, you and I could compare notes, because I also grew up without a dad, but I think our experiences and men and women are very different. And I'm wondering now, what did growing up without a father take from you? And when I say take, the image I have in my mind is like violently strip off you, and that you've had to work so hard to rebuild or to become as a man in society.
You know, I think it took a lot from my older brother, and more than it did from me, because that guy was always there for me. I saw him though grow up so fast, having to be responsible. There was a point where my mother was struggling, you know, and my brother had to come back from school, drop off everything and go be a mechanic and fix cars somewhere. And then come back and you know, and that also, he was too tired to do everything. He didn't even complete his matric, you know, because he was always working at, I think he was like 16 or something. But what that has showed me is that, you know, a man must stand to stop the next generation of fatherlessness. My brother is there for his children. I'm there for my children. And one thing that we took out of it is that you do not leave your children when they need you the most. Yeah. Even when they don't need you. You know, I've got teenagers now. Even if they don't need me, I'm still there to say, hey guys, just shout, I'm here. So, yeah.
Oh, man, the thing with events like this is that it leaves a trauma, right? The event is long gone, but the trauma remains because our body keeps score. Our mind never forgets. And so did you not find yourself experiencing a certain fear or a certain, I don't want to say imposter syndrome, but a doubt, a fear and a doubt in your abilities to be a father, and perhaps even that thing that will sit on your shoulders to say, how good are you from your dad? You can also do this to your own children.
Sure. I think I lived almost the rest of my life saying, I'm going to be a great dad. Yeah. I'm going to be different.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was 25, 26, before, I think a year or two before I got married, I was listening to a sermon, and this man said, you, as a young boy who grows up without a father, you grow up the rest of your life trying not to be your father.
That's so true.
And then realized later that you did not develop your own character because you were trying so hard not to be somebody else, but you were not becoming somebody else. And that's when I decided, let me find myself. Let me get to know who I am, what makes me happy, what makes me tick, what are my strengths as a man. And therefore, you know, when I got married, I was ready to say, when a baby comes, obviously there are those nervous moments. But, you know, between men and women, we worry about different things. We worry about provision. Is the house safe for a baby? Women worry about different things. So I wouldn't say that not having a father was traumatic for me as such. I think I had a lot of people that protected me.
Amazing.
From my brother, from my uncle. It was this uncle of mine. And when he passed away, his death really broke me because that guy was there. That guy had a job, but he attended my brother's soccer matches. You know, I still picture my uncle running through the line when my brother was playing soccer, you know, shouting and screaming, buying him soccer boots, all those things. So my uncle was present, and then after he passed away, there was something else.
And what was the most difficult lessons, or some, even if it's one, that you had to unlearn as you entered manhood?
I think, you know, and you know, just to be blunt, you know what happens to a boy's body when he turns 13? So at that moment, I really needed my father. And I think that moment could have turned my life to a different position, because my brother was just 3 years older than me. He didn't know better. He also grew up without a father, you know. So when I turned 13 and things happened to me, I woke up in the morning, washed the blankets, and then I went to my brother and I told him what happened. And at that moment, I realized that the difference between having an older brother and having a father, an older brother will tell you you are ready for things that you're not ready for. But that moment when I needed my father, he could have directed me to a certain position. And that's why a lot of young men start to have sexual intercourse at 13, because they think that they are ready for it. But that moment defines you to say, now you are ready to step into another chapter of your life.
Oh, man. And I know there's so much more to you than this fatherlessness, right? And so we'll move on. After this question, we'll move on to the other many facets of you. what I'm curious about, and I don't know what happened to my question. It was literally in my mind. I don't know why I forgot it, but I'll come back if I do remember it. Oh, no. Here it is. It's a bit of a sensitive one. And if you don't want to answer it, that is okay. You know, in a lot of homes, because a lot of homes, especially Lokshin, are matriarchal, right? They are single parents, single mothers. And grannies and aunts, it's just the lineage of single mothers and single women raising children. And oftentimes, we're afraid to have these conversations with these mothers and with these aunts about where our fathers went, what happened, and all of that. I'm curious about whether you got the answers to where your dad is, who he is, as a matter of fact. Was there anyone you could comfortably ask those questions? And even if it wasn't comfortably, but that you could ask those questions. And have you met your dad? Did you finally find out where he was? Or uzwe ukuthi he's passed away, guy?
First of all, let me say your radio station has been interviewing me, I think, for like 3 or 4 years now.
Yeah.
There is nothing I'm uncomfortable answering.
Okay.
I answer everything.
Fantastic.
So I remember there was a point where I asked my mother, Mom, who's my dad?
Mm.
Who is my father?
Mm.
Oh, man, she was so upset, you know. And I kept asking every year, you know, trying to tread carefully. Unfortunately, I never got an answer. I asked my aunt, and my aunt said to me, you know, your mom and your uncle, the uncle that was taking care of me and my brother, my aunt said, your aunt and your uncle would be the two people that would know, because they were very, very close, even when they were young. And I remember one time my mother and my uncle were having an argument, and my uncle sat there and said to my mom, why don't you tell this boy who his father is, right? And my mother faked a seizure there, and she was shaking. I remember that moment vividly. I think I was 12 at that time. You know, I remember everything. And from that moment, I never asked my mother about it again.
Yeah.
And then she unfortunately passed on, and I never got the answers. But for me, that I remember I was getting married, and somebody said, don't you think this issue troubles you? Then you want to go for therapy. I went to therapy, and the therapist said to me, why can't you let this thing go? I said, it's difficult for me to let it go, because it's black, that it's black people, you know, our culture.
Yeah.
Whether we believe in culture or not, the important thing is that a son or a child belongs to the father.
I mean, it's a huge part of your identity.
Exactly. And the therapist said to me, it could be that there was an embarrassment in the family. That's why everybody's not talking about it. It could be a product of rape. That's why your mother didn't want to talk about it. It could be a lot of things that could have happened that could have been embarrassing to your mother. And that's when I decided to just let it go.
Yeah.
I don't think I want to find out if I'm a product of rape. But, I think,
yeah.
I hope I answered you.
No, you did. You know, the internet is silly. Sometimes the internet is good, and sometimes it's so, so silly. I remember seeing a meme the other day that said, how come you're a life coach? We're all doing this for the first time. So how do you know life secrets? And I want to know what drove you to life coaching, especially grief, because your grief and life coaching, what is it that you had to grieve that gave you the voice and the depth of getting into this kind of coaching? And then you can talk to us about life coaching as well. Is it one package? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think life coaching is just another additional thing. But my specialty is really in grief.
Okay.
Not only have I experienced grief, but I studied grief. I studied about behavior after grief. I studied a lot of things.
Was this after your uncle?
Pardon?
Was this after your uncle?
That's after I lost my wife. In 2010, I got married in 2009. So in 2007, I met a lovely lady in Rembeck, and we never, we were meant to be friends, but we got together, yeah. we got to know each other.
Yeah.
The funny thing is we met around September. It was towards her birthday. Her birthday was the 5th of September. We met towards September. We got engaged the following year, 2008, around September on her birthday, exactly on the 5th.
Yeah.
And we got married the following year on the 6th of September.
Yeah.
And we buried her around September as well.
Patrick, come on.
Yeah.
You guys did not even experience much of marriage. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, we just experienced it, just a year of marriage.
Horrible. And that is what started your journey in grief coaching.
So after going through the most horrible 8 years of my life, well, it's been 15 years now, but I realized after 8 years of grieving that there's somebody out there who's going through what I've experienced through the 8 years, who wants to give up, who thinks this pain will never go away. So how can I help them? And that's when I started to write about it a bit and check out the market and speak to people. 2020, then I started writing books. 2019, actually, I started writing books. In 2021, just the month before COVID.
Yeah.
Then I published a book titled Does Time Really Heal? From there, then I started getting invites in radio stations, and I got invites from church to talk about it. I got invites for prayer to talk about grief and how it affects their workplace. And then I decided, man, let me take it up a notch, and I did some courses in grief.
And
that's where it was born.
Yeah, and your book asks such a pertinent question. Does time really heal? What were you doing in these 8 years that was rendering your time quite futile? Because you do say that the time will pass, whether you choose to use it productively or not. What did you find, what were your mistakes that you did in those 8 years that you that left you unhealed during all that time?
I tried to do something to remove the pain, right? I tried to pray harder. I'm not saying people shouldn't pray, but I cast out the, you know, when we're young Christians, I cast you out pain,
yes,
I cast you out.
Yes.
But yeah, but we're not really dealing with it, you know. We're just trying to magically pray it away. Luckily, I went to some friends of mine. I must tell you, at that time, I had money. I had a good job. I was working really well. I had the abilities to buy myself as much alcohol and get drunk as much as I could.
Yeah.
But I went to my friends and I said to them, guys, please buy me alcohol. Oh. And obviously, they know that I can afford to buy myself, and they saw it as a cry for help, to say, okay, you don't need alcohol, you need us to intervene and do something. And those guys really, really saved my life. I don't know where I would be if I had started drinking at that time. I looked for things. I, you know, put full tank in the car, traveled to Bloemfontein, because when I was on the road, I couldn't feel the pain. It was nice. I would eat and drink Red Bull all the way. It was nice, and peanuts. So I try to put things, instead of dealing with the pain and dealing with the grief, I try to put things in the middle to fill me up and do things that can help me sleep at night and not deal with the pain. And only after 18 years, basically from when it happened, up to 8 years, I wasn't dealing with it. And I realized that I was I was basically a walking corpse.
Oh,
I was just sitting there eating and you know, just basically just walking around doing nothing. Only after 8 years, then I started the process, and I said, no, I want to heal for my children, and I started therapy.
Oh, man, I am so sorry. That is a horrible experience, you know, and I just can't imagine. It's 1 year is barely enough. You had only known your wife for 3 years. It just wasn't enough time. And I can imagine that in that time, apart from dealing with the pain of losing somebody you love, there are also so many questions. I'm currently studying the book of Job. And Job, he's just like me, of all people. Can I just know what it is that I did? Why have you turned your back on me? And it's the questions, right? Apart from the fact that his health is ailing, his kids are gone, his livestock is gone, it's also just he can't reconcile what is happening with the promise of, and I guess in your case, the promise of marriage, the promise of spending a lifetime with this person, of love and all of that. I'm pretty sure it was a horrible time. And that is why it was so difficult for you to deal with it. And 8 years is a long time. But again, if you don't know what to do in the 8 years, it will go by and you look back and you realize, oh my goodness, I actually went down that grave with the person that I lost. And I think this is a value of coaching, right? Because what coaching does is that it collapses time. Somebody took years and years and years learning a skill and making the mistakes and getting things right, and you get that perspective and that experience and that tenderness and that understanding and the platform where you are seen through the journey and the experience you're having. And so I just want to know, what makes your particular coaching unique? I mean, everywhere you turn, there's a coach. Every video you play on YouTube, somebody is selling you a course and a coaching package and all of that. What is it that you say to people is the value that you add to their lives?
You know, I want to go back to what you said a little bit before I answer that question. You said that when your loved one dies, you die with them. Right? And for that 8 years that I was literally in the grave and buried in there, there was nothing that I could learn. But after that 8 years, I realized that sometimes you have to die to be born.
Oh, that is so good.
And that is what I use in my coaching sessions. I try to find where the person died, did they die, and try to raise them up. And this is what I always tell I almost call them patients, but my clients.
Yes.
This is what I tell my clients, that if you know where you died, then you know where to pick it up. Most of us, most people die and never ever come back.
No.
That's why you see that a man was married, he had a beautiful wife and beautiful kids. I remember when I was publishing that book, somebody said to me, you know what, the things that you wrote in here, my mother died many years ago. My dad has never been the same. My dad was a loving man. My dad was, he always used to joke. But since my mother died, that man died. He never came back. A lot of people never come back. So how do we bring them back? People always ask me, what do you say to bring people back? One thing that I'm experienced, and it's good that I have the experience of it, is that we talk too much when somebody comes to us and say,
Job's friends,
coach. When somebody says, coach, I need help, what do I do? What do you want to do as a person? Sometimes somebody can go 10 years without knowing what they want to do. You know, just wanting to heal is not enough. What do you really want to do? And when they find the answer, then they can get them out of the, get themselves out of the grave. I'm not a coach that will talk for 30 minutes without the client saying anything. because I would let the client tell me how they feel. Mm. And that's how people who are grieving want to be treated. Mm. They want to sit there with you, even if you're not a coach, yeah. and they come to you.
Yeah.
And they want to sit there with you, and they want to tell you how they feel. Mm. They don't want to hear, "Hey, Baba, I know how you feel." Mm-hmm. No, you don't. Mm-hmm. Even if Rimajita and we got married and we both lost our lives, mm-hmm. I'll be lying if I say I know what the next person is feeling. Yeah. I will only know yeah. if they tell me. Let us wait and let them tell us mm-hmm. how they feel. Mm-hmm. So that we can find solutions together.
Yeah.
I'm not there as a coach that's going to find solutions. I'm there to help you find solutions. Mm. We find them together. Yeah.
So good. So good. Have you since remarried?
Not at the moment. I'm not married, no.
Do you have a desire to?
Oh, yes. I think for the past, remember I said there was that 8 years of zombieing out.
Yeah, yeah.
And from that 8 years, you know, I really worked on myself. Mm. I started training, exercising, running is the one other thing that got me out of that mindset of it happened to me, you know. Mm. And I started seeing it happened for me.
Mm.
You know, even though somebody died, but it changed my life. It changed my whole view of life.
Mm.
I started seeing myself differently. Mm. I focused on helping other people. The more I help other people, I did not neglect myself.
Mm.
The more I helped them, the more I also came back closer to God yeah. because I was foul.
Yeah.
I could sit in church and people would be preaching, "God is love."
Mm.
And I'm sitting there and I'm like, "God,
where is the love?" Yeah.
You know, and I've, throughout my speaking, throughout my engagement with people, I've been honest to say that there was a point where I just didn't believe that God has something for me. But when you heal, and I want to get to that point, I don't know if you were going to ask me that.
Go ahead.
But when you heal,
yeah.
but when you heal, there's that thing that shows you that, yeah, I almost died.
Mm.
But God sent somebody. That other night, the way I decided I'm going to commit suicide, a phone rang. It was God looking out for me. You know, that morning when I just about to give up on my life and my daughter woke up and smiled and giggled and she went back to bed, you know, it changed my mind. God was always there. There are traces of him everywhere. He sends people when you're about to give up. But we don't see that at that moment when we are hurting because it is just too painful.
Mm.
We are full of hatred for the people that died. When I looked at my wife, I was like, "Dude, you were not that sick. How could you just
yes,
that?
Yes.
Yeah, you know. And that hatred just boils inside of us and grows, and there's nothing that we try to do, and we can't see properly, you know. We're not blind, but we cannot see properly.
Mm.
And I'll tell you that if your spiritual eyes are not opened through this whole process, if your spiritual eyes are not opened, you will get stuck there blaming God for the things that he allowed to happen for his glory through your life.
And what have you found the glory to be? What is... Apart from the fact that you are now really showing others how to go through it, right? You're giving them tools.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting them to think differently. What apart from that, because this is what I'm thinking, when you describe to people what the glory is from this situation and what you've gone through, what do you say?
I think the one point, unmistakably, that if I didn't see the traces of God, I wouldn't have made it. When all my strength and all my diplomas and degrees couldn't get me anywhere, when all the connections that I had couldn't get me healed, all the people that I bragged about knowing, all the I've got friends who are doctors and psychologists, and they couldn't even reach me. But you know, God sent ordinary people that were not educated, ordinary people that didn't know things, ordinary people that didn't even know me sometimes, to help me and to show me that I can make it out.
Yeah.
And that's where the glory is, to say, when everything else failed, God showed me that He's God. And He delivered when I didn't see myself laughing and talking about it without shedding a tear. I can only be God.
Yeah.
It can never be done by human strength. Many times almost died. But I see the footprints of God to say, hey, that day, that small thing that changed my mind, that can only be God. It can never be the devil, obviously.
I think you understand God's omnipresence more tangible than most people do. The fact that He's
Absolutely.
Everywhere in everything. That is so beautiful. Neo the Soul Healer. Which book of the many that you've written, of the multiple that you've written rather, was the hardest to finish? Which one took you through your paces?
Hard to finish. I don't know. I think you know, one of the gifts that God has given me was just to write and write. And I'm not the person who talks a lot. You know, under any circumstances. The first book that I wrote, a lot of people don't know about the book. It actually took me 4 years.
Okay.
I couldn't find the closing statements. But every time I found the closing statements, let's say I would wait 1 year without touching the book. When I go back to it and reread the book, my English would have changed. The English that I speak, the English that I speak this year, next year will be different. And then I would say, no, I'm not impressed, and I would, you know, remove it.
Yeah.
But when my wife died, 2 years later, I found the finishing of the book. And then I just wrote it in 3 months and finished it. I remember my daughter, she used to cry. But when she was 1 year, a couple of months, she wasn't crying anymore. So she would play on the ground and play and play. And then I would write the book in the middle of the night. And then when she starts crying and coming to me, I know it's her time to sleep. And then I would take her and then I would sleep. So that was the hardest to finish. But after that, you know, any normal person who is a normal writer can finish a book in 12 days if you're doing 12 chapters. If you're doing 20 chapters, you can write one chapter a day and close the book. There are people who believe that if you are flowing, you don't have to stop at one chapter. But I always said, if I stopped, then I found a different perspective tomorrow, and I can write a better story. So, yeah, books that not breaking, but books can take long. Yeah.
Now, are you self-published?
Yes, I am. The first one is not.
Okay.
The first one was published overseas.
Yeah.
So I don't. They just paid me and then took the book. I used to get royalties, but it's been so long.
Is this the one that you took 15 years to write? 4 years to write?
4 years, yes, that's the one. And then the others I published for myself. I still plan on publishing. I've got a 40 books version. 2040, yeah.
Interesting. And what informed your decision to self-publish instead of going the traditional publishing route?
I think you need to be a little bit famous to get noticed by the publishing house.
No, I hear you. Please talk to one of my listeners or a couple of my listeners who are currently in a dark room of grief. Perhaps they're feeling the dark thoughts that you once did, possibly even feeling suicidal and dead. In fact, I think suicidal is at least you're thinking about it, but like they feel dead, like they are gone as well. What is your prescription for getting through the next 24 hours? Not even a year, just the next 24 hours.
Yeah, you know, grief is very, very difficult. Yeah. And it is something that we are extremely careful about when we speak to people that are in it. You could be speaking to somebody that lost their partner, their spouse, a month ago. There's possibly nothing that they're going to hear or understand. But the most important thing is patience. Mm. Nobody gets anywhere without patience. To say, yeah, I use my life and the lives of others that I know as an example to say, 10 years ago, we didn't think, or 15 years ago, I didn't think I was going to make it. Mm. But I'm here today. I'm talking about it. And the most important thing is to find somebody who wants to listen and talk about it. Do not just sit at home. It is a step-by-step thing. But I remember staying in a room. I didn't even open a window. Mm. The first time I took a step was, I'm going to open this window today. I'm going to get up and I'm going to open this window and I'm going to get into bed. Mm. Then the next day I said, I'm going to open this window, but I'm not going to get under the blankets. I'm just going to sit on the bed. Mm. The following day, I didn't sit on the bed. I sat on the chair and I made tea.
Oh, wow.
And the more I got up and got closer to the door, the more I was able to get to the door. And one day I sat there, I took a chair and I took another one and I said, you know what, I am no longer praying, which I don't do anymore. I do not walk around the room, chant and pray and whatever. I sit down, take a chair and talk to God and tell him everything. Mm. So now if you're here and you're listening to my voice, I want you to tell him everything. God is the only one that you can honestly pour your heart out to without holding anything back. Even if you tell him, God, you broke me.
Yeah.
You broke me.
Yeah.
You know? That's honesty. You're honest with God.
Mm.
And God is not going to be laughing and going on one of those radio stations laughing at you tomorrow that you told him he broke you.
Mm.
That's the only God. God is the only one that's going to listen to you. It's not going to judge how you feel.
Mm.
God, I'm weak today. I don't know if I can make it.
Yeah.
God, I want to cry today.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Tell him honestly how you feel.
Mm.
Grief is not a, if we could just press a button,
mm-hmm.
it's over. We would do that, but we can't. Be patient with yourself. Be honest with God and how you feel. And do not expect to wake up tomorrow all healed and everything. Just work on it and find a reason to live. I found a reason to live through my daughter. Said, I cannot have my daughter grow up like me when I grew up with her parents.
Yeah.
I want her to know me. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Tate Mabiletsa. Thank you for your work. Thank you for wearing your heart on your sleeve, for sharing your pain, the deepest, darkest parts of your pain, because only after people have seen those shady, crooked parts that you don't want anyone to see can they see themselves. It's very interesting that people see themselves in the darkness, in our darkness, as if our darkness is their mirror. But when they don't see that, they can never see, one, that it's not a unique experience in that other people experience and go through it as well. And two, that it can be healed and something can be done. So thank you for opening up. Thank you for opening the wounds and the scabs and the pain, because people have found and are finding healing because of that bravery. And I pray that God expands your territory and that you find love and happiness and joy again, and that you continue to do the work with even more fervor and strength moving forward. Thank you for coming through.
I appreciate you. Thank you for your time.
All righty. And with that, I am Nompumelelo Mbonani, and I hope you have just made sense of whatever it is that God has allowed for you to go through. Let's do this again next week, Monday. Fresh mercies tomorrow. Ciao for now.
Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.